Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, CIA Director George Tenet is set to name a White House official in the controversy over questionable intelligence.
In Iraq, a significant day in July, or Tammuz.
In Iraq, Saddam was often equated with Tammuz, as if he is the god of resurrection.
And maybe even Saddam doesn't know the truth about weapons of mass destruction.
In a regime really ruled by terror and fear, there were very few scientists who were ever going to stand up and admit that they didn't reach 100% of production.
Also, a study that shows that kids in daycare are a little more disobedient.
These stories and your postcard poetry coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. U.S. forces in Iraq say they're bracing for more possible attacks. Today is a key anniversary for Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. This is the first time since Saddam came to power in Iraq that Iraqis have not marked the date with fanfare. And as NPR's Eric Westervelt reports from Baghdad, it has U.S. troops on edge.
Officially, anyway, U.S. military personnel say there are not heightened security precautions in place, but in reality, every soldier on the street and patrol in Baghdad and surrounding cities knows that this is a special week for former Ba'ath Party members. It is the anniversary of the 1968 revolution that brought Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party to power, and it's expected that there'll be potentially more attacks today, although so far it's been relatively quiet.
NPR's Eric Westervelt in Baghdad. At present, there are about 160,000 U.S. and allied forces in Iraq. In the latest audio tape reported to be that of Saddam Hussein, the deposed Iraqi leader calls for a holy war against the so-called enemy of Iraq. In the statement aired today on two Arabic-language stations, the speaker refers to recent events in Iraq, fueling suspicions that Saddam is still alive. Hot, dry weather is complicating firefighting efforts against Oregon's largest wildfire. The Clark Fire is now at 1,500 acres. Jenny Newton from member station KLCC in Eugene reports.
Just 20 miles east of Eugene, Oregon's second most populated area, the Clark Fire continues to consume recreation areas in the Willamette National Forest. Helicopter traffic is limited by proximity to Eugene's airport, but the choppers are the only way to attack the blaze as it swoops up hillsides in steep terrain. Dave Woodmark at the Fire Information Center says the four copters are dropping retardant and water on flare-ups, but he says things will get worse on the Clark Fire.
Big problem we're looking at right now is just the hot weather that's in the forecast over the next 4 to 5 days. Lower humidity allows higher flame lengths. Definitely it's going to make it a challenge for these firefighters.
Woodmark notes the fire crews on the ground, nearly 500 people now, are also feeling the heat, weighed down by heavy fireproof suits and boots. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Newton in Eugene, Oregon.
The search for answers into yesterday's deadly incident in Santa Monica, California, is underway. Police searched the home of 86-year-old Russell Weller, who plowed through an open market, killing at least 9 people and injuring more than 40 other people. Authorities say they were looking for medications and any other clues that could explain Weller's behavior. Initial blood test results showed no sign of drugs or alcohol in the driver's system. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 18 points at 9,076 in heavy trading of 692 million shares. This is NPR News. In this NPR business update, General Motors posted a sharp decrease in second quarter earnings today, but the world's largest automaker still managed to exceed Wall Street predictions. From member station WDET in Detroit, Celeste Headley reports.
GM officials blame the decrease on expensive incentives and the high cost of closing an Oklahoma City plant hit by a tornado in May. They say they're also struggling through a 12% cut in production and high pension expenses. The automaker posted a net income of more than $900 million, or $1.58 per share. That's a significant decrease from last year's earnings of $1.3 billion. But GM's earnings are still higher than analysts expected. Experts predicted the company would post earnings of only $1.19 per share. North American auto profits actually fell far behind earnings in the Asia-Pacific region, and the European division lost money yet again. For NPR News, I'm Celeste Headley in Detroit.
The U.S. is apparently out of another recession and has been for a long time. The National Bureau of Economic Research says the 2001 recession was concluded in November of that year. The announcement came after the group saw, on one hand, that unemployment was on the rise, while on the other hand, the gross domestic product resumed growth late in 2001. During a two-day congressional meeting this week, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan indicated the central bank was still worried about the risk of deflation. Recapping figures on Wall Street, the Dow is down 18 points at 9,076. The Nasdaq is down 34 points at 1,713. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
White House officials say nonsense to claims made today by Illinois Senator Dick Durbin. Durbin said on ABC's Good Morning America that CIA Director George Tenet testified that it was a White House official who insisted that questionable intelligence regarding Iraq's nuclear intentions be included in the president's State of the Union address. Democratic Senator Durbin repeated his version on the Senate floor earlier today. Joining us on the line from Capitol Hill is Thelma Lebrecht. She's senior correspondent for the Associated Press Radio Network. And Thelma, I'd guess Washington is buzzing about Senator Durbin's comments.
Indeed so. It was rather a revealing comment that was made after a closed-door session with CIA Director George Tenet. Afterwards, Senator Dick Durbin said that Tenet basically said that a White House official had insisted that President Bush's State of the Union address include that statement, the line, the 16-word line, about Saddam Hussein's nuclear intentions, that Iraq was trying to buy uranium from Africa. Of course, that line blamed it on British intelligence officials. After the meeting with Tenet, Durbin came out to tell reporters that Tenet had, in fact, named that official, but Durbin says since it's a closed-door session, he cannot name the person. But he says this should make the White House very upset. They should actually unveil who that person was and why, Durbin says, they were trying to mislead the American people about that statement.
Thelma, what is the speculation as to who that White House official is?
Well, Durbin says he can't reveal it, but he expects it will come out. But so far, he does, in fact, say that that person is still there. So that would eliminate, say, for instance, an R.A. Fleischer, who is now deported.
Well, let's mention a name raised this week in another context, Vice President Dick Cheney. A group of retired intelligence officers this week demanded that he take more responsibility in this issue. And it was his office that sent an ambassador to Africa long before the State of the Union speech. And that ambassador found no truth in the uranium story.
That's right. John Wilson was that ambassador. You're quite correct, Robin. And in fact, Cheney also made several trips to the CIA to sort of get his talk to analysts there to sort of encourage them to look deeper into any possible ties about Iraq's nuclear weapons program, as well as about any possible ties of Iraq to al-Qaeda and possibly linking Iraq to the 9/11 terror attack. So, in fact, Vice President Cheney took a very strong position and personally intervened, going to the CIA and taking a very strong interest in the CIA analysts.
Is there a sense that, as some of these former intelligence officers say, he should take more responsibility for what's happened?
Well, basically, this also splits along party lines. You have to remember this was Durbin speaking. Many of the Democratic presidential candidates have latched on this as an issue. You do not see many Republicans coming forward asking for anyone to resign. Plus, you do not see the Republicans calling for an immediate congressional investigation. So there is some split along party lines in this regard.
Thelma, thank you.
Robin, thank you. A pleasure.
Thelma LeBrecq, senior correspondent for the Associated Press Radio Network.
Two and a half months now since President Bush announced the end of major combat in Iraq, a congressional subcommittee will hear testimony tomorrow about the problems delivering humanitarian assistance there. What they hear, they may not like. The security situation remains unstable, electricity supplies are intermittent at best, and many have no clean water. Pat Carey is a senior vice president with the non-governmental organization CARE. He'll be among those delivering a report card tomorrow. He joins us now from the CARE office in Atlanta, and welcome, Pat.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
What will you tell Congress tomorrow about the current situation in Iraq?
Well, my major message tomorrow will be that the essential security situation remains very difficult, makes it very difficult for CARE to implement its programs, and that the remaining continuing absolute top priority is for provision of basic security to allow NGOs to do their work and to restore a sense of feeling of security among the Iraqi population.
Well, is there a sense that things are at least, however slowly, getting better?
Well, we testified in Congress several months ago in May, and our feeling is that situation is not noticeably better. And in fact, in some ways, there are worrisome developments. Although the attacks are primarily aimed at coalition forces, in recent times, we also have seen attacks aimed at civilians working on restoration of electricity. The World Food Program, one of CARE's partners, has reported that there are increasing number of attacks on food convoys. So I'm afraid that I would like to be able to report that security is better, but from our point of view, it is not, in fact, significantly better.
Well, that must be enormously unnerving for you that some of your people could be targets. What does it mean for average Iraqis? How to get the humanitarian assistance they desperately need to them?
Well, it affects, of course, average Iraqi citizens on a number of levels. For example, recently we wanted to supply high-protein biscuits for malnourished children at a particular health center, and the authorities at the health center said, please don't do it because we're afraid that if we have the biscuits, we'll be looted again. What we want you to provide is increased a security gate, better windows, and so forth. And, of course, it also affects restoration of normal life, particularly such things as the return of children to school and particularly the return of girls to school, which is an absolute high priority.
So what is the average day for an average Iraqi? 115-degree temperatures, no proper water, no sewage, let alone electricity for air conditioning.
Right. In fact, just most recently in June, there was a whole three-day period where there was no electricity whatsoever. That, of course, cuts down on the water supply, making that difficult. And then because water is not available and because the sewage plants are not operating, you're getting incredible backups, discharge of sewage into the Tigris River, backup of sewage systems, and we're seeing an alarming increase in the percentage of ill people who are coming forward, particularly children with diarrheal diseases, which we think is directly related to the sanitation and the lack of basic services restoration. So, and also because of security, people can't obviously go out at night. It makes it difficult to reopen businesses, which slows down the economic recovery. So I would say it's very difficult for the average Iraqi.
So it's the vicious cycle. Things don't work. The economy languishes. Things don't get fixed. Crime gets worse. I guess we have to point fingers. Who's not getting something done that needs to get done to make life better for your people over there and 24 million Iraqis?
Well, I mean, I think the basic understanding is that the coalition forces, as the occupying powers, are the responsible authorities for providing both an essential level of security, which allows resumption of normal life and allows for our activities to take place, and also, of course, is basically at this point responsible for the restoration of basic services, which would make life more normal for the average Iraqi citizen. We just do not feel yet that the achievements have warranted an ability to say that we're at where we should be at this point after the full military conflict is over.
Pat Carey, thanks very much for joining us on this.
You're most welcome.
Pat Carey is a senior vice president with the NGO CARE.
And this note, tomorrow in Here and Now, we'll hear about a new move by supporters and critics for more scrutiny of NGOs like CARE, and other non-governmental organizations, groups that are increasingly shaping public debate. The new commander of Allied forces in Iraq says American troops there are facing a classical guerrilla-type campaign. The words of General John P. Abizaid contradicted those of Donald Rumsfeld, who last week said this is not a guerrilla war. And they come as another audio tape surfaces, purportedly of Saddam Hussein denouncing Iraq's new governing council. Perhaps one reason for this increased rhetoric? Well, today is the 17th of July, formerly one of the most important holidays for Saddam's Ba'ath party, perhaps second only to Saddam's birthday, and one of six Ba'ath holidays outlawed last week by Iraq's new council. Well, joining us on the line is Amatzia Baram. He's professor at the University of Haifa and senior fellow at the United States Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C. Good afternoon, Professor.
Good afternoon, Robin.
Well, first of all, tell us again, what makes the 17th of July so significant?
Well, that's when the Ba'ath Party came to power in Iraq in 1968, and this is the most important calendar day for the Ba'ath regime in Iraq ever since they were in power. Except one has to remember that this was the second time they came to power. First time was in February of 1963, and they lost power after a few months, and they could never, ever forget that.
Yeah, and in fact, the very word July in Iraq has significance?
Yes, very much so. July in the Arabic is Tammuz, by the way, like in Hebrew. Tammuz was the god of fertility and resurrection in ancient Akkadian and Sumerian mythology. In Iraq, Saddam was often equated with Tammuz, as if he is the god of resurrection and rebirth and so on. So yes, 17 Tammuz, which is 17 July, is also sort of very rich in associations connected with Saddam.
Yeah, it's the name of a nuclear reactor there. And
yes, that's true too.
Is it, I mean, for comparison, would it be sort of like our 4th of July in this country?
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. Absolutely, yes. As important. But one has to remember one more fact. Because it was the second time they came to power, and because after they lost power for the first time a few years earlier, they suffered in jail and the persecution. So they decided we shall never, ever lose power again. And Saddam, in close session meetings with his senior party members, said in the 1970s that if they, the party, he and the party, lose power again, there will be no Iraq. This is meaningful for today because all the operations they are carrying out today are done without any inhibitions. They are happy to risk the lives of their own citizens, shooting from within civilian crowds. They are happy to destroy power stations or destroy water purification systems. They'll do anything to destroy Iraq in a way that the Americans will be blamed for it, and eventually they will inherit Iraq again. That's the way they look at it.
What's your guess, though, from stateside? Are there people who are also perhaps happy that this holiday has been outlawed?
Those people who are shooting at your soldiers are very, very miserable that Saddam is gone because they lost a huge amount of perks and privileges. They were the privileged class, the Sunni Arabs of Iraq. It's a minority, 15% only, but they are very unhappy, most of them. Most people in Iraq, though Shiites and Kurds, are very happy that Saddam is gone and, of course, will never celebrate again the 17th of July. So the question is whom you are dealing with.
Mm. Well, Professor, thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Amatzia Baram, professor at the University of Haifa, and now senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C.
Look, just ahead, what Iraqi scientists and intelligence officers are telling their U.S. interrogators, that there really weren't any weapons of mass destruction.
And later in the program, a study measured the work performance of exhausted medical residents and found they performed as if they were drunk.
There's more coming up here and now. We'll be right back.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
That Saddam Hussein wanted to create a nuclear weapon and did create vast amounts of biological weapons as well as tons of chemical weapons is not a matter of debate. According to the UN, Iraq caused at least 80,000 casualties from chemical weapons in the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s. Now, another war was just fought in part on the theory that Iraq's weapons of mass destruction were still a threat. U.S. and British intelligence officers are currently interrogating dozens of former Iraqi scientists and intelligence officers to try to end the debate on WMD. What they've learned, for the most part, we don't know. Though we may be able to get an idea from recent reporting by Bob Drogon, who's national security reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke to several of the same Iraqi scientists and intelligence officers now being questioned by coalition authorities, and what he heard appears in this week's issue of The New Republic. We're joined now by Bob Drogon, and thanks for joining us, Bob.
My pleasure.
Well, Bob, to start off with, just how many Iraqi scientists and intelligence officers did you speak with?
I spoke to about a half dozen in all.
Mm-hmm.
All but one had been interviewed by U.S. and British authorities. The other one was essentially an intelligence officer, and he was, in fact, hiding from them.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of your key sources was a man named Dr. Alaa Saeed. Who's he?
Dr. Alaa Saeed is a 51-year-old chemist who was one of the founders of the chemical weapons program that Saddam Hussein started in 1980 and became the head of quality control for all of the production runs that they did for the various chemical agents that they produced.
He was also deputy minder to the UN inspectors after 1991, wasn't he?
That's correct. He was. He worked with the UN inspectors, and he, in fact, was the chief author of the various declarations that Iraq presented to the United Nations Security Council for their chemical weapons program.
Let's talk first about what Dr. Saeed told you about VX nerve agent. Now, that's, of course, the extremely lethal, paralyzing nerve agent first produced by the British in the 1950s. The alleged existence of VX was a reason the Bush administration repeatedly used for going to war. And after many denials in 1995, Iraq did admit it produced nearly 4 tons of VX. But what did Dr. Saeed tell you happened to all that VX nerve agent?
Dr. Saeed claims that essentially they stopped producing VX in 1990, but that because the Iraqi authorities after the Gulf War, according to him, were so desperate to get the UN to end the sanctions and to end the inspections that he was told to burn his documents, destroy his records, and essentially deny the existence of the program.
So simply enough, the 4 tons of VX nerve agent, they were never able to prove they destroyed it because they were forced, these scientists were, to destroy the records.
It's a bit broader than that. The problem was that at the end of when the UN inspectors were forced out of Iraq in 1998, there were allegations that Iraq still retained precursor chemicals that could produce
right.
hundreds of tons more of VX. And that was the stuff that was at issue as to whether that existed. And if so, was Iraq hiding not 3 or 4 tons of VX, but 200 tons of VX?
Right. And what did Dr. Saeed say about all that, if anything?
He claims that it just never existed, that they were never able to really weaponize it, and that more broadly, he and other scientists claim that, in fact, any of the weapons that they were producing from back then, or most of them, by now, 12 years later, would have deteriorated and would have been no longer really very useful.
Dr. Saeed was one of the prime authors of 3 of Iraq's chemical weapons declarations to the UN, including the 12,000-page document presented to the Security Council last December. Now, all those declarations ended up being considered bogus, but if they had so little or nothing to hide, why didn't they prove that to the United Nations and the rest of the world?
Well, here we move sort of more into the speculative side, and this is really a compilation of what Dr. Saeed and the other Iraqis say, and frankly what the UN inspectors I've talked to now believe, which is a sense that, in fact, the programs really were eliminated by the mid-1990s. And that for a variety of reasons, mostly having to do with Saddam Hussein's pride and his fear of appearing weak, that he refused to admit that that had happened.
Is there unanimity among the several scientists and the intelligence officer you spoke to that by the time we went to war, these weapons indeed did not exist?
Yes, there is. And I should add that I also spent a week with the U.S. and the British and the Australian weapons hunters, and I think there's growing belief among them as well.
Now, do you think this is what interrogators of these scientists are hearing? Is it conceivable that eventually they will report to the higher reaches of our government and of the British government that, you know what, we had it wrong, they didn't have this stuff?
Secretary Rumsfeld was asked about this over the weekend, and he said, yes, they are hearing that, and I know for a fact that a report to that extent has gone to the White House. What, of course, we don't know, is what else they may be hearing and whether there's anyone who's giving them anything more valuable than that. Obviously, they've clearly not gotten anything yet that has pointed them to any substantial stockpiles.
Bob, could these scientists be afraid to admit what they know about what existed or still exists because most of them now realize, as we apparently do, that Saddam Hussein is still alive?
Absolutely. I think there was an assumption before the war that once Saddam is gone, there's no reason to lie, and I think that was another miscalculation. There is every reason to lie from their point of view. For one thing, some of them have blood on their hands. They've taken part in programs that were in violation of UN resolutions. Secondly, there's tremendous confusion in Iraq as to how you'll be treated by U.S. British authorities, whether you'll be treated as a hero or as a villain. We now know most people there absolutely believe Saddam is alive, and whether or not he is or not, that his henchmen clearly are operating. And
right.
There is a real fear that cooperating with the American military occupation could endanger your life or that of your family. And I don't think anyone yet sees the financial reward as so substantial that they are willing to take those risks, given what they know what happened last time the Americans were there, which is they left and thousands of people were killed.
And you're certainly not arguing that Saddam Hussein became disinterested in having this material.
Absolutely not. I believe that the goal was to simply wait this out in the idea of someday reconstituting weapons. So, no, he was not, you know, an innocent here by any stretch of the imagination.
Bob Drogon, thank you very much for speaking with us about this.
My pleasure.
Bob Drogon covers national security for the Los Angeles Times. His article, The Vanishing, appears in this week's issue of the New Republic magazine.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, coming up, a new study finds kids in daycare are disobedient and assertive. But does that have to mean daycare is bad for kids?
I really think parents have to make good choices that will enable them to be good parents. I don't think these data mandate any specific life choice for families.
And our roving poets are back with their latest poetry challenge, Postcard Poems.
The years at the spring and days at the morn, mornings at 7. The hillsides dew-pearled, the larks on the wing, the snails on the thorn, God's in his heaven, all's right with the world.
These stories coming up, Here and Now.
I'm Dolores Handy. British Prime Minister Tony Blair is in Washington today for a meeting with President Bush and a speech before a joint session of Congress. Blair's visit occurs as both leaders are being criticized over intelligence used to justify the war in Iraq. Congress had been expected to present a Medal of Honor to Blair during this visit, but controversy over the war has caused a postponement of that presentation. A senator who heard the secret testimony of CIA Chief George Tenet yesterday says Tenet named a White House official who insisted that President Bush include a dubious claim about uranium in the State of the Union speech. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin has demanded that President Bush give a full accounting to Congress on the issue.
Do I think the president intentionally misled the American people? There is no evidence of that whatsoever. And I've not heard a single person say that he intentionally misled the American people in making that statement. But I will tell you this, there were people in that White House who should have known better.
Asked repeatedly if Mr. Bush is responsible for what's in his speech, the White House spokesman said the issue has been fully addressed. A new tape has surfaced with the purported voice of Saddam Hussein. An Arabic-language television station today broadcast an audio tape it said came from the toppled Iraqi leader. The tape charges that leaders of Britain and the U.S. lied to their people to justify waging war in Iraq. And it denounces the newly formed Iraqi Governing Council as a tool of the U.S. South Korean officials say troops from North Korea fired first in a brief gunfight along the border of the two countries. The soldiers traded machine gun fire in the heavily patrolled demilitarized zone. Meantime, the South Korean press is reporting that Pyongyang is considering China's proposal for talks over the North's suspected nuclear weapons program. The 2001 recession ended only 8 months after it began. That's according to the National Bureau of Economics Research. Today's announcement came after the economists struggled for months to reconcile the fact that even though the U.S. economy resumed growth in late 2001, unemployment continues to rise. News is raising eyebrows among some economists who are questioning the timing of the statement. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are lower. The Dow is down 32 at 90.62. The NASDAQ is down 38 points at 1709, and the S&P 500 is down 9 points at 984.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
And it won't come as a surprise to anyone who's pulled an all-nighter. Sleep-deprived people don't perform as well as those who are well-rested. But new research out of Brown University shows just how poorly an important group of sleepy people performs. Dr. Judith Owen's study of medical residents shows that after a month of night call duty, they drive as though intoxicated. Joining us to talk about her research and its implications is Dr. Owens. Welcome.
Hello.
Well, Doctor, I know that you used a driving simulator to evaluate how residents drove after working and staying up for prolonged periods of time, and you compared those results with how the residents drove when, frankly, a little bit drunk. So tell us, how did the residents do while driving under the influence of sleep deprivation?
Some of the performance measures on the driving simulator, like driving off-road, keeping a constant speed, even being involved in simulated crashes, were equivalent to or worse than in the sleep-deprived state as their performance was when they were moderately intoxicated. So one of the points that emerges from that, really, is we need to be concerned about residents driving home post-call.
Something you know a little bit about. Didn't you yourself have an accident?
I did. My
my very last night on call as a pediatric resident in Philadelphia, I had a car crash. I also think that there have been some recent changes in resident work hours that actually went into effect July 1st of this year. But I think that it's very important not to rely strictly on work hour guidelines, but to also educate residents about things that they themselves can do to be more aware of the effects of fatigue.
You're talking about the new rules instituted by the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education.
Correct.
That limits residents' work weeks to 80 hours. Some people might be astonished to know that residents were working 100, 120 without the rules, and 80 still seems like a lot. But this seems even more important, not just because of how residents might act, but how they might think. You found that they might actually start thinking negative things about the patient?
That came from a focus group study, which we actually conducted with residents across the country. And many of the comments that residents made were regarding their relationships with other staff members and with patients, and how being sleep deprived really impacts on their empathy. That's one of the things we're looking at in this particular study, and also hopefully in future studies. The residents were clearly very unhappy about that effect of being sleep deprived, but in some ways feel really powerless to prevent it.
Yeah. Well, doctor, what about, I've read so many doctors saying that this kind of work schedule for residents is important because it's the only way to guarantee continuity of care. You know, they take a patient through a patient's care, and it's the only way to learn.
Well, you know, there are a lot of arguments that have been made in favor of perpetuating the particular system that we have of training residents. I think there is some legitimacy to the concern about continuity of care. However, there are communication systems and checks and balances that can be built into the system to really avoid some of those types of errors. To argue that residents need to learn to function under those conditions, I think really has been largely disproven by other research on the effects of sleep deprivation. One of the most important things to remember about sleep deprivation is human beings are very poor at judging how sleepy they are. Mm-hmm. So when you ask people, are you okay, their answer isn't going to be a true reflection of what they're actually able to do.
Right. Well, Dr. Owens, thank you so much.
Very welcome.
Dr. Judith Owens is an associate professor of pediatrics at Brown University. She spoke to us from Providence.
New parents often worry about whether or not to put their kids into daycare. Now, a study is shedding more light on just how tough that decision is. The study just published in the latest issue of the journal Child Development found that the more time children under the age of four spent in childcare, the more adults described them as assertive, aggressive, disobedient, and less likely to get along with others. The National Institute of Child Health and Human Development funded the study. Dr. Kathleen McCartney was one of the study authors. She's a professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and welcome, Dr. McCartney.
Thank you.
So, doctor, is this clear-cut? Are kids in daycare more aggressive, more assertive, more disobedient?
There's not a simple answer to that question. It's true that we find an association between hours in care and teachers' ratings of behavior problems. That's true. It's a fact. But I think it's important to know that the effects were small. For example, the effects are smaller than what we see with respect to associations between family variables and behavior problems. So parents have more of an input on their children's behavior problems than the child care setting does.
How was the study conducted?
We recruited about 1,350 children in 1991, and we've been following these children and their families and their child care providers and now their school teachers ever since.
You alluded earlier in our conversation to the fact that a lot of it has to do with how parents are engaged with their children.
Variables like how sensitive mothers are to their children and even family income have stronger associations with behavior problems than the number of hours in child care.
Well, you know, that sounds a bit like common sense.
Well, I think a lot of what we find in psychological research is actually common sense. But on the other hand, childcare is such a new phenomenon. Uh-huh. In fact, more than half of infants in this country are in some form of childcare, that parents and policymakers have really wanted to know what the effects of childcare are.
Is childcare bad for kids? I guess that's the simple $64,000 question.
I really don't think that it is. When you talk about childcare, you really need to talk about the quality of the setting.
So boiling it down then, what would your main message be to parents who are contemplating whether or not to put their child in daycare?
Parents have to make good choices that will enable them to be good parents. And for some parents, this means working full-time because they need the money for personal fulfillment or for both of these things. For other parents, I think it means working part-time or not working outside the home at all. I also think families need to remember that the quality of their parenting is the most important predictor of their children's development. And by good parenting, I mean a lot of things, like being sensitive and responsive to your children's needs, setting appropriate limits for your children, loving children. I think parents really need to monitor their children's development. They can observe for themselves whether or not their children seem to be having behavior problems. I mean, if they think they're seeing a lot of aggression or noncompliance, there are lots of things they can do, like talk to the child care provider and even bringing concerns to their pediatrician. Parents need to find the best care for their children that they can.
And, of course, every child is different, too, right?
That's right. I mean, it's quite possible that the children who are at risk are children who are difficult temperamentally. I mean, some children really are born in this world just being a little bit harder. I mean, right now, these are hypotheses that we have that we hope to test out in future analyses.
No easy answers and not much black and white in raising children.
That's right. This is a nuanced set of findings.
Dr. Kathleen McCartney, thanks so much for joining us on Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Kathleen McCartney is a professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education.
Still to come, weather's great, having a wonderful time, wish you were here. Our roving poets explain postcard poetry.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
In a segment on the airline industry, we stated that the war in Iraq is officially over. Listener Kevin Heiser of Philadelphia took exception to that. He writes, "The war is not officially over. In 1991, hostilities were temporarily stopped due to a ceasefire. But the U.S. has been conducting airstrikes on Iraq on an almost daily basis for the last 12 years. When President Bush declared an end to major combat, a conscious decision was made to not declare the war over."
Several listeners emailed us after our Washington roundtable discussion, which focused on President Bush's now discredited assertion that Iraq was seeking nuclear material from Niger. Joseph Galushi of Phoenix wondered whether our panelists were partisan when they questioned President Bush's credibility. He wrote, "Funny, no one questioned former President Clinton's credibility, leadership, or truthfulness when he uttered his words, 'I did not have sex with that woman.'" Well, Joseph and I have exchanged several pleasant emails in which I pointed out that his point is true until that little impeachment process.
Oh, yeah, that. First Lieutenant Stephen Santa Maria wondered, "If the inaccurate remarks by the president had been made by a prominent newspaper or other news agency, would we be making such a huge deal of this? Mistakes like this happen all the time. For example, the Clinton administration's failure to interpret intelligence accurately in Mogadishu. I have to wonder if this isn't just an attempt by the left to discredit the president."
Last Wednesday's interview with Washington Post Bureau Chief John Anderson drew this reaction from listener Fred Schwartz of Pennsylvania. Anderson stated that organizations like Hamas and Islamic Jihad have been radicalized by the fighting of the last 3 years. He should be aware that the fighting started a few weeks after Arafat walked away from a possible settlement brokered by Clinton, and that the fighting was initiated by a rash of attacks and suicide bombings by these already highly radicalized terror groups.
And now a listener email from last week's letters segment recommending that we drop cooking segments from our show, inspiring some food enthusiasts to put down their spatulas and write. G. Borger says, "In the letter segment last Thursday, you included one that said, 'Stop the food recipes. You cannot smell over the radio.' I must respectfully disagree. Not only could I smell the mixed berry and peach cake, I could taste it as well. Keep the recipes coming.
Ah, we love a good food fight. D.N. Brannon agreed. When I heard the recipe for the berry and peach cake, I went to your website and printed out the recipe before the segment was done. I'll be making that cake tonight.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Lorraine M. took exception to Ellen Pfeiffer's negative comments about the two tenors, Marcelo Alvarez and Salvatore Lecitra, and their new CD, Duetto. I saw Duetto recently, she writes, and it was refreshing to hear music that was not on the usual hit parade of tenor arias, and that the tenors were singing with each other and not the traditional first me, then you style seen in other concerts. I felt so strongly about this CD that I just had to write.
Well, as always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please remember to include your name, phone number, and the town where you live. And stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Nel suo alma una interna e ocean, quando la mujer te da su amor.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Wish you were here, a phrase that's graced the backside of many a postcard, and while it usually means you're somewhere exotic and far away, at the moment it leads us straight to two people who are sitting right here in front of me in the studio, Here and Now's roving poets, Molly Sicardo and Jim Burley. Hi, guys.
Aloha.
I wish I was here.
You are here.
Oh, I am here.
You are here. I can confirm that. Molly, you're responsible for this new poetry challenge. What's a postcard poem?
Well, a postcard poem is really just a descriptive poem that would fit on the back of a postcard. You could actually put it on the back of a postcard and send it to someone describing where you are right here and right now.
Huh. Well, Jim, did you find any postcard poems?
Well, there's a great tradition of postcard poetry. It's been this great way that poets often can write to one another, can share thoughts, and correspondence has always been very important to poetry. Out on the West Coast in San Francisco, there's a poetry publisher called Poetry Espresso that asks poets to write postcards to another poet for a month. And so what happens in the middle of this is sort of not just a correspondence, but sort of a longer poem, I guess, the sequence of poems. One of the poets is named Stephanie Young. This is called Postcard Poem. Dear Catherine, the days get so dark in winter. There is rain and a wagon to fall from into the pillowy arms of a holiday. We go from preposition to preposition, singing and carrying boxes. With coughing, seizure of air in the eyes of a neighbor, our neighbors, we used to say, are everywhere. There's something also about the brevity of these poems, I think, and maybe Molly will talk more about that. In fitting on the back of a postcard, you're limiting your lines, and so you're trying to be as descriptive as you can and trying to capture as much as you can.
And what you just read was written to somebody named Catherine who would then respond to it.
They were moving, yeah, actually. Yeah. And so Catherine's like, yeah, we're moving. You know, it's hard.
Molly, more examples?
Sure. This one was not, I don't think, designed for a postcard. In fact, I'm sure it wasn't. It's part of a longer passage, but it's called Pippa's Song from Robert Browning, and it's pretty familiar to people. But it's a short description, telling right where that person is right then and how they feel about it. The years at the spring and days at the morn, mornings at 7. The hillsides dew-pearled, the larks on the wing, the snails on the thorn. God's in his heaven, all's right with the world.
A 19th century postcard poem.
There's a lot of immediacy here, too. You know, you're sort of saying, well, this is what's going on, you know, sort of in trying to capture that moment of I'm sharing something with you and you're far away and I'm trying to communicate that to you.
And it's tough to write something well that's very short.
Ooh, I don't know. You know, there's all sorts of in your ability because you have a small amount of space. It forces you to try to do interesting things, to get it to jump off the page, I think.
Right. You can do a whole vista, or you can concentrate and focus on something really small. This one, it doesn't exactly follow our example, because, again, it's as part of a longer poem. And this is by Deborah Garrison from a fabulous book called A Working Girl Can't Win, very hot book from a couple years ago. And it's called Worked Late on a Tuesday Night. Again, Midtown is blasted out and silent, drained of the crowd and its doggy day. I trample the scraps of deli lunches some ate outdoors as they stared dumbly or hooted at us career girls, the haggard beauties, the vivid can-dos, open raincoats of flap in the March wind as we crossed to and fro in front of the public library. Never thought you'd be one of them, did you, little lady?
She's great.
Yeah, she is.
It also depends how your handwriting is, how long the poem is. I mean, if you print really small, you know, it could have a very long poem. Wallace Stevens has a poem called A Postcard from the Volcano that is a lot longer than I thought when I found it in his collected poems. It was a very long postcard poem, and I'll just read the very end of it. It's called A Postcard from the Volcano. A part of what it is, children still weaving buddied arroyals, will speak our speech and never know, will say of the mansion that it seems as if he that lived there left behind a spirit storming in blank walls, a dirty house and a gutted world, a tatter of shadows, peaked to white, smeared with the gold of the opulent sun. So you can be very descriptive and very, obviously, paint a very vivid picture.
Very beautiful, too. Molly?
Wallace Stevens is just wonderful on description. He captures and makes you look at a detail and then lets you feel an emotion about it. And that's, I think, really what we're trying to get at with these poems.
Interesting to bring up Wallace Stevens because so many of his poems are so long.
Right. But he also wrote a lot of short ones, too. But here's another summer poem by a more current poet, Walter Dean Myers. And it's called Summer. I like hot, hot days. Sweat is what you got days. Bugs buzzing from cousin to cousin. Juices dripping, running and ripping. Catch the one you love days. Birds peeping, old men sleeping, lazy days, daisies lay, beaming and dreaming of hot days, sweat is what you got days.
Well, that's a great summer poem.
Yeah, you know I picked that just because I wanted to read it.
We paint a heck of a picture on the back of a postcard.
Well, we got poems too, Bill.
You do? I'm shocked. Let's hear them.
Well, my postcard poem is a postcard to the Poet Laureate of the United States, a postcard to Billy Collins. You'll think I'm kidding. Here the days last 30 seconds and the nights a year. Everything as can be expected from birds, trees, stars. Billy, I saw your face in a puddle lit with laughter. I figured you'd be mad, these lines long and untangling, squirting like squid legs off the postcard, like yawn, which I just miswrote as yawn.
Squirting like squid legs. Molly.
That's a good one. Mine is generally to anyone dealing with the beach. It's called Building. Just before the cymbal crash of waves, sand, wet by buckets of water, builds to a gritty complex of bridges, turrets, towers, and tunnels. Yellow shovels and blue trowels shape the structures. Small hands pat-pat the sand in place. Construction began with two young boys. They enlisted a dad to haul water. Three more boys and a big brother couldn't resist the dig. Now a mom adds seaweed and shells to the dwellings. Like an orchestra, each member performs in harmony for the whole. Like symphony music, the majesty will fade with the departure of the players.
You see, Molly's handwriting is probably like, what, 6 points? You know, how did you get all that in there?
It's under 14 lines.
It's a heck of a postcard.
Under 14 lines.
But as always, we want to open this up to our audience too, right, Molly?
Right.
What are the rules of engagement?
Okay, for this one, it has to be 14 lines or less.
Ooh.
Because no matter how tiny the writing, you got to be able to fit it on the back of a postcard. So 14 lines or less. Descriptive of where you are here and now. It should pretty much be written in the present tense. I think that should be a part of it.
Don't be afraid to be summary. Don't be afraid to be descriptive. Tell us about where you are.
Okay, listeners, the deadline for your postcard poems is Monday, July 28th. Please visit our website to submit your poems and for the rules of engagement. It's here-now.org. That's HERE-NOW.ORG.
And if you know, you got the postage, just put it on a postcard and send it to us. It's Here and Now, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215.
Again, the deadline is Monday, July 28th. It'll take some time for us to read over your work. Then we'll contact a few of you to talk about your poems.
We're looking forward to see what kind of postcards you send your poems on, so do it that way if you can.
And thanks, Jim and Molly, as ever.
Our pleasure.
Here and Now's roving poets, Molly Sicardo and Jim Burley. For the rules of engagement and to submit your postcard poems, visit our website, here-now.org.
And we'll see you soon.
Aloha.
So you think you can tell heaven from hell, blue skies from pain? Can you tell a green field from a cold steel rail? A smile from a veil, do you think you can tell? Did they get you to train?
Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Boris Trapatsky. Our web producer is Zach Christo. Our intern is Allison Vence. Thanks to Emiko Tamagawa, Jordana Gustafson, and Andrea Meyer.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us Here and Now.
Wish you were here. We're just two lost souls swimming in a fishbowl, year after year, running over the same old ground. And have we found the same old fears? Wish you were here.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for... I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for...